For decades, America has tried to combat the harms of drug use primarily through banning drugs and incarcerating people who use them. But this has caused a violent underground market for drugs, increasing crime in our communities. It's caused contaminated substances, increasing overdose deaths, and it's caused incarceration to skyrocket, destabilizing families. What we're doing isn't working. Crime, death, and broken families are the collateral damage of using the criminal justice system to address the public health issue of drugs. If you're looking for a better path forward, you're in the right place. What if we changed our drug policies to prioritize life, health, harm reduction, and thriving? And what if it benefited all of us? Our criminal justice approach to drugs had a beginning, and it can have an end. Join us on the journey to end it for good. I'm Christina Dent, your host, and if you're new here, End It For Good is a nonprofit started in 2019 based in Mississippi that invites people to support approaches to drugs that prioritize life and the opportunity to thrive. This podcast is one of the ways we do that. You can head over to episode 34 to hear my story as a conservative Christian foster mom changing my own mind on the best path forward with drugs, and then come on back and dive in deeper. I didn't change my mind overnight, and most other people don't either. We all need time to learn, think, ask questions, and explore. Whatever your perspective is, I'm glad you're here. Let's journey together. Welcome back to the End It For Good podcast. I'm Christina Dent, your host, here today with Megan Perry. She was one of our speakers at our Shift to Drugs and Addiction Summit last year. So amazing and compassionate. And I love her heart, especially around storytelling, not just the importance of storytelling, but how to tell our stories in a way that we don't regret later. And I think that's really important, especially in the work that we do around addiction and recovery. And there can be a lot of pressure to tell your story. And once you tell something publicly, you don't get to take it back. And so I just love Megan's work teaching people how to tell their stories in a way that they won't regret later. And so, Megan, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thank you very much, Christina. I'm really glad to be here.
So give us a little kind of short, who are you? You know, I don't like reading bios because I think that people just tune out when you're reading something off a page. Tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do.
Yeah, I'd love to skip the bio because then the person whose bio it is just feels really uncomfortable while right. You're reading the thing about the person.
Exactly.
So I'd much rather tell you in my own voice. I am a person in recovery from a lot of different things. I have a lot of lived experience that informs the work that I do here, and that also informs the work that I do in my business. I have a business called Megan Perry Group, and we do education, training, learning experiences of all different kinds, as well as a lot of speaking and keynote work and coaching. So I work at an intersection of storytelling, theater, and recovery coaching. And really just brought together are the things that were helping me and the things that do still help me just live a self-directed and fulfilling life. That's always looking for greater wellness. And so I just love people and I want everybody to be just well and feel loved and have as good a life as I do, even when we're facing challenges. So the work that I do is really just focused on helping people have the best life that they can see for themselves.
So tell us about kind of the storytelling piece. What has convinced you that it's so important? And you can tell us some of your story too, if you want to, in that, but just that it's hard to tell our stories. It's hard to let other people in on your own journey. And there is some wisdom definitely that's needed in how we do that, how much we do that with who, but talk us through kind of how you envision that piece of storytelling now, its importance, in this space of recovery.
Yeah, I mean, I learned about it through my own pain, really, of sharing my story. I started sharing my story in advocacy spaces around criminal justice reform and recovery, addiction recovery. And I found that it was causing me harm in the way that I was telling, because no one had really told me how to share my story. And so it was coming from some spaces with a sort of limited framework of how I might share my own personal experience. And so I got into the craft of storytelling, the art of live personal narrative storytelling, and that just opened up a whole nother world, another way of sharing stories. And so over the years, I've come to really believe really, really strongly in that we each have to find our own way to share our personal experience. And I think what happens is that we kind of have these dominant narratives, whether it's in criminal justice reform, whether it's in harm reduction, whether it's in addiction recovery or mental health recovery or trauma, or all of these challenging issues that we're having these public discourses about, that there are these dominant narratives, and then we learn how to kind of follow along. We match the story model of whatever groups that we identify with most strongly. And that creates this kind of mono myth, this mono story that is like we're all just telling someone else's story. We're just adding some of our own details. And so that becomes tokenized, and that becomes cliche. And so we just hear the same things over and over, and it doesn't have the same depth of meaning. When we're able to find our own voice, and to really tap into the truth of our experiences on not like, getting beneath the surface, then we're speaking from heart, we're speaking from universality. Because the cliches and the kind of things we hear all the time distance us from what storytelling really has the power to do, which is to move hearts, not just minds. We move minds for sure, but storytelling really gets to the heart, and that's where change happens. And if if you look at advocacy and how it works, we know we have to move the heart to get that call to action to happen. So whatever it is you're passionate about, whatever it is that you're speaking about, bringing in your own experience is one of the most powerful ways that you can move hearts and minds. And we've got to get out of this kind of stale, formulaic way of talking about things to get to that level. And particularly in the recovery movement, we have a formula, and the vast majority of people are using that formula because it's all that they know. And so, the most effective stories that I hear from others are the ones that are just the unvarnished truth, and very, very personal. We say in storytelling that the specific becomes universal. So when I give you specific details, you're able to connect to it in a way that's much more powerful.
I think one of the I was actually telling somebody about this the other day from your speaking at the addiction conference that we just hosted in November. One of the things that I remember most of it was you making the sound of the cell door closing when you went to go get medicine while you were incarcerated and pregnant. It was so powerful. It was an interesting, I don't hear people do that when they're speaking, of kind of adding a sound into that. You're telling lots of words, but there was an inclusion of what it sounded like to you. And that was just so powerful. So I want to talk a lot more about kind of the framework and how, what people need to know, what they often don't know about sharing publicly that they should know on the front end. I want to talk more about those kind of specifics, but take us into your life a little bit, into how you came to this, the pathway that you have taken that has given you such a passion for helping people specifically in this space of recovery from lots of different kinds of things in their life.
My life was dominated by mental health and substance use challenges from my mid-teens on. I found myself at 28 years old, incarcerated, 5 months pregnant, using methadone to support my recovery, looking at a 2-year prison sentence. And in being in that situation really, it at the time I really wanted to, and I did blame myself and look at all of the things that I did wrong and all the choices that I made and how it was my fault that I was there. You know, it was horrible, horrible circumstances. And what I'm able to see today is that I just had a really lousy set of circumstances. And I didn't have the support that I needed. That was just one touch point out of a long, long journey with mental health and substance use challenges. But I look to that moment, and that's the story that I shared at the summit, as the sort of highest point of blaming myself, and kind of being in the trap of this moral idea about substance addiction, and being just as sort of under that, the influence of that way of thinking, as anyone from the outside who would be judging me for being pregnant on methadone, incarcerated, looking at 2-year prison sentence. And so it was just a time that really exemplifies the way the system even makes us ourselves believe that we're bad for having a challenge like that, when the reality is that I have, you know, a problematic relationship with substances, and I had no supports, and I was just in a milieu of challenges and things that were working against me to put me in that situation. But at the same time, looking back, right, and being able to storytell about it today, I can see that I was doing my absolute best. I wanted nothing more than for my daughter to have a better life than mine. I wanted nothing more than for her life to start differently. And the reality is that I was in the most horrible circumstances to begin her life. But I was trying, and I wanted that better life for her more than I cared about my own life at that time. I just was unable to do anything about it. And so that, you know, it took me many, many more years to find my own recovery and build my life back together, and much more involvement in the criminal justice system along the way. I was able to keep custody of her until she was 4. I lost her for 6 years. Was incredibly, incredibly blessed to get her back when she was 10. And that was the very, very beginning of my own journey of the recovery that I have now. I know my recovery started the first day I decided I wanted to change and do something about it, which was back in 1995, right? But the recovery lifestyle that I have today started back when she was 10 and I got custody of her back. And that was 12 years ago. So, but it's, you know, it's in that time that I'm able to go back and change that story for myself. And that for me is the internal power of storytelling, of having an opportunity to go and question and challenge and look at the things we've been telling ourselves. And in that way, breaking free of that kind of that stigma and that outside idea of what people like I am like, and what, you know, how we got into trouble, and, you know, all of these kind of moral elements about addiction and incarceration and all that. And so our stories have so much power to unlock that new perspective, and we can share them really effectively to change the way. If I'm not carrying a lot of shame about it, it's much harder for you to put the shame on me, because I can speak with dignity, you know. And this is, you know, sort of getting into like what what is different in really powerful storytelling. Like, what do we need? We need autonomy. We need to be able to decide what the story is and how to tell it, and having dignity in it, and having compassion and love for the person that I was at the time that that event happened. I love in your book, I just finished reading it, and it's wonderful. You just have this really clear compassion for the person that you were at each stage of your learning process, right? Not blaming yourself for having a certain mindset or belief system, and there's no wrong in it, right? It's just like, oh, this is what I knew, so this is what I, how I felt. And then that process of changing your mind, you have compassion for yourself throughout all of that. And so when we tell stories like that, like we tell stories with compassion for ourselves, it engenders compassion from others. When we tell it with dignity, it encourages dignity from directed from others to us. And so it's really, really powerful what we can do with story. And it's certainly been a big part of my healing process. And certainly now, you know, it's kind of my life's work.
Hey friends, this podcast is just a part of the work we do at End It for Good, inviting more people to this conversation on changing the way we approach drugs and addiction. We want strong families, safe communities, and policies that uphold the dignity and value of every single human life. If you're not signed up for our monthly newsletter yet, head on over to enditforgood.com, scroll to the bottom of the page, and sign up. You'll get all the info on the rest of the work that we do, including live events, and it'll get you plugged in to the End It for Good movement. So what do you think that people don't know that they should know before they start telling their stories? You talked a little bit about kind of the positive impact that that can have of helping, certainly people get a better perspective and helping us understand our own stories. The process of really thinking about how would I communicate this experience helps us to make meaning of the stories that we're telling. What are some of the other things and maybe some of the risks and things that people should be aware of kind of on the potential, landmine side of things they might not see until much later that you would want people to know before they're kind of out there sharing?
I think it's really important. Of course, you have to decide what you're comfortable with sharing. So in a moment, you know, there's been times that I've shared something that felt good in the moment, or felt like it was appropriate in the moment, and then realize later, like, you know we live in the digital age, everything lives forever. And that I felt safe in that, in that moment, but ooh, it wasn't something that I wanted forever, for everyone forever. And really good, like I'll say, really good interviewers or podcast hosts or whatever will create a space in which you can really share authentically. But you just have to be, you know, you kind of have to be mindful, like, you know, think that through before you even go into the situation of like, you know, this is an area that I'm not comfortable sharing with, or, you know, protecting our privacy is really important, protecting the people who, the other characters in the story. I've long talked about my daughter from, you know, I started doing advocacy when she was like 12, maybe. And so, you know, just being mindful over the years how much I share that was specific to her, always, always, always talking to her, like, hey, you know, I'm gonna share in this place and I wanted to talk about this. Is that okay with you? So, you know, definitely thinking through what do I want to live in permanent record that anybody in the whole wide world could hear. Being very intentional about what you're sharing and why. So, you know, values are really a big part of storytelling. And so what are your own values and how are they being conveyed through the story? And how are you staying true to them as you're story sharing? And I'll be very sort of transparent, right? At the summit, you said, oh, you have extra time. And that, you know, even as seasoned as I am, I was like, oh, what am I going to do with the extra time? Because I want to be very sure of what I'm sharing. And I'm like, well, if I just go off, there may be something that I say that I wish I hadn't said it that way. And it's on the permanent record. And, you know, so it's like, just really take that time ahead of time to be clear about what your message is, what you want people to know at the end. I always ask three questions for people when I'm helping people get ready to speak. What is it about? Like, what is it even about? Oh, it's about my recovery. Well, you got to get a lot more specific than that. You know, it's about a woman who was incarcerated while pregnant and faced, you know, X challenges. What is the most important thing in your story or your talk? What is the core truth of it, so that you stay close to that? And the third one is, what do you want people to know or feel when you're done, so that you're very clear about what you're talking about and why? And you then want to put that in the context of who's asking you to speak, or who's giving you the opportunity and the platform. What are their values and what is their intention? One thing that I see a lot of, especially with people with lived experience in whatever it is, incarceration or trauma or addiction or whatever, is tokenism. And so a lot of times there'll be an event and it's all what I would call, I mean, they're all very valuable, but, you know, there'll be the dignitaries, like the required, you know, politicians get to go first, and then there's the judges. And these are all people that are important to have in the conversation. And they're like, oh, and then we just need somebody with lived experience. And so we're kind of just plugged in because you're supposed to have somebody with lived experience. But if you look at where we are in the lineup and, you know, what else is happening, right, is just sort of evaluating those things before we go into it, so that we can see what they're actually looking for from us. And maybe that's an opportunity for us to speak truth to that power, or to use that opportunity, right? We still can use those platforms, or we may say no to them, but retaining your own dignity and keeping in line with your own values are worth looking at before you step out onto any platform. There's definitely been times where I've spoken afterwards, I'm like, ugh, I could feel yucky to have been part of that particular lineup, and all the, like, a lot of the other things that were said that day, I'm like, oh, I don't want to represent this event or these values. So just knowing what your own truth is and what your own intention is, and how that fits in.
Yeah, it's not, a similar thing happened to me one time. I agreed to speak somewhere, and then the more I learned about it, the more I thought, I don't think this is actually something I want to be connected to. But it's difficult to get an invitation where you want to, you know, it's like, wow, that's, I mean, it is. And you've done a lot of speaking, I've done a lot of speaking, and there's always a sense of what an honor it is. It is an honor to be entrusted with time in front of an audience.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of, no matter what that is, somebody that has seen you as a person that would provide valuable communication to whatever audience it is that they're curating a speaker for in whatever capacity. And so there's always this part of me that's like, my default is always wants to be yes, because I see it as like, it's a great opportunity to like bring the message to more people. And yeah, there definitely are these questions of need to know more about it, need to know what this is really about, what's their ultimate goal with this, is this something that I'm going to feel good about being part of, or is this something I'm going to feel like maybe I feel good about what I said, but I don't feel good about contributing that to the whatever the, you know, the broader event was. Maybe it was, you know, for us, like, kind of style and approach are really important, and so is it an event that is consistent with our values of respectful dialogue, of inviting people in, of giving people safety to consider new ideas? Or was I the one speaker who was committed to that and everybody else was, you know, breathing fire at the audience? I don't know. So there's just those questions. Is it worth that? Is it worth bringing that? Or does that feel like it's not a good fit for us because it just feels off kilter of the types of things that we, you know, are wanting to be part of. So I think that is an important thing to think about. Even if it's the very first time somebody has been invited to speak somewhere, you're always, you know, it becomes part of something you've done. It becomes part of this sort of a resume of sorts of kind of the types of things that you're involved in. And so I think that's just wise to say, think about that. You know, this is, it's not about, can I get somewhere? It's about what is consistent with who I am, maybe the organization I work for, or what I want to build in the world. Those are just important things to be considering. So for people, I know there's a big movement of recovering out loud, of telling your story. And certainly there are many people who are quietly recovering, and that is okay too. What is your perspective on that and on kind of some of the things that maybe would be good for people to know as they're deciding, you know, do I even say publicly that I am a person in recovery from whatever it might be? Maybe it is substance use disorder, maybe it's something else. How do you think about that when you're talking to people who might, maybe they're in really early recovery and feel like I can conquer the world because I have been sober for 60 days. This is going to be my new life. I want to tell everybody about it. What are some of those things that you think are just good wisdom from what you've learned?
Yeah, I think it's a really big decision to make to when you decide to, you know, I kind of jokingly refer to it as coming out of the closet, right? Because, you know, it's very similar. It's a big decision. It's an important decision. I think it's one that should have consideration. One of the things that I see a lot is, and again, this goes to like the intentions of the person asking. So in the treatment industrial complex, in the recovery movement, there are a lot of times where people are asked to share their experience of recovery for someone else's gain. And often the people in recovery don't realize that because, like you said, they're just so psyched. Like I was just so excited. I was doing advocacy when I was still in treatment. I was like, you know, on this part of this Bangor area recovery community coalition, and you know, so in there and very public. One of the downsides to that is that if you don't sustain that recovery long term, so if you have a return to use or some kind of a resumption of symptoms of you know, all the things that come with your substance use, then you're already public. And so there are, unfortunately, so many ramifications of that because of discrimination. And so you will face discrimination. We are all facing discrimination as people with, you know, problematic substance use or mental health challenges or whatever. But just talking about problematic substance use for the sake of this conversation, we're facing discrimination all the time. So the more public you are about it, the more you're making yourself available to that discrimination. So it's just something to consider. I've made I don't want to say a career out of it, but obviously, you know, I recover incredibly out loud and I have from the very beginning, but I've had a lot of privilege too. And it hasn't cost me as much as it may cost somebody else who doesn't have, you know, family, financial security and, you know, housing security and multiple opportunities for career paths and all of that, even as somebody who's been convicted of a felony. I still have so much privilege. So, you know, it's worth considering if I had a return to use and everybody knew about it, what are the ramifications of the discrimination that will happen as a result of that? Also, you know, just ask yourself, why do you want to recover out loud? How will it benefit you by doing this? And in recovery, we're so focused on service to others because our dominant pathway is like, you have to give everything away that you got because that's the only way you can maintain your own recovery. And I'm not sure that that's so true. you know, I think service is a tenet of many belief systems and it's important. But so a lot of folks in recovery also believe like I have to go out and do this to save other people. We can't save people. Like we don't have that much power. There's only, you know, depending on what your belief system is, that's not our job. But you know, in order to help people, yes, we can help people with our story, but also how are we helping or harming ourselves? And I think that honestly, the majority of people that I see sharing their recovery stories are actually doing some harm to themselves without realizing it. And
In
so,
what way? Like what, how would people, give us an example maybe, or something that, or in what way, I guess, could it harm somebody to tell?
So we put ourselves at risk of that public scrutiny, right? And that takes many forms and faces and may happen then, may happen later. The dominant narrative in recovery is that I used to be very bad and now I'm good. And there's this binary, there's this lynch point, there's this tipping point of I used to use, I don't use substances. And so we kind of castigate ourselves and call ourselves sick and diseased and disordered and bad, and I, you know, no morals, and I didn't care about anybody, and we're still telling ourselves that that is part of who we are. And so we're going out there and we're speaking that way, and it's way more complex than that. And there was nothing bad about me when I was at the worst stages, you know, when I was incarcerated, pregnant, there wasn't anything bad about me. I just had a lot of challenges, and that's what they looked like. That's the face of how they showed up in my life. When I speak badly about myself like that, I'm talking about everybody else in the present who's still struggling. I just want to put that out there. That's one of my biggest things. If I say, oh, I had no morals, I was terrible, I was sick, diseased, I'm telling all the folks who are still struggling that that's what they are, sick and diseased and no morals, and they don't care about anybody and they're bad people. But I'm also telling myself that a big part of me, all of those past selves of me who are still part of me, are bad. So that's part of sort of that, how the dominant narrative can play out. I'll give you one example from the storytelling work that I do. Is a woman who did the workshop with us. Her name is Kath. I have her permission to share her story. Her daughter died of an overdose at 21 years old. And Kath, from fentanyl, acute fentanyl poisoning, Kath had been telling the story to other young people. She went and did, went to schools and, you know, did all this work in sort of the prevention world, as like Emily's story was like the cautionary tale of how evil fentanyl is. And it's killing people and it'll kill you if you use it and that kind of a thing. So that was her story of Emily's death. She came into the workshop. I did some coaching with her. She went through the process, and all of a sudden she started to tell the story about hummingbirds. And how hummingbirds, she had never seen a hummingbird nest until she was pregnant with Emily, and there was one in her yard. And it was such a big part of like the beauty of that time of her life. And that the hummingbirds kept coming around sort of as markers in Emily's life. And then after Emily passed, the hummingbirds came again. And so all of a sudden her story was about Emily. And her story was about Kath. And the story was about beauty and love and loss. But it was Kath's story and Emily's story, not the story that society was trying to get her to tell about fentanyl is evil, everything's against fentanyl, 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 right? That robbed Kath of her own story. And it robbed people of the ability to connect authentically with that loss and with that life. And so it became a completely different story. So the harm that we can do to ourselves is perpetuating the stigma, the discrimination, the self-loathing, the keeping ourselves like small and in boxes and limited definitions of ourselves. I always say, you know, I used to be like an addict, which I don't like to use that language anymore, but that's what I call myself. I was an addict. And then for the beginning of my recovery, I was a person in recovery, but I was always attached, right, to the fact that I used to have a problematic relationship with substances. Now I just like to be a person, a whole person. Right. And that fullness is what we bring when we can tell our stories from that fullness and not from inside those boxes. But so much of the time we're telling from inside boxes, and we're keeping ourselves limited, and I had a definition for myself of addict felon. It's like I had a box. Addict felon, that was all I was. That's all society said I was for so long. And I believed it. And I was doing advocacy and all of this speaking from inside the box, harming myself, harming other people, perpetuating the stigma without even realizing it.
If you're listening, you're interested in solutions so that fewer people are harmed by drugs or addiction. Hop on our website and grab my new book, Curious, A Foster Mom's Discovery of an Unexpected Solution to Drugs and Addiction. It is a memoir of my learning journey on these issues. It starts when I'm 9 years old and continues through the founding and growth of Endeavor Good. But it's really more than a memoir. It includes the stories of people like Michelle, who found a unique path to sobriety, and stories like James, who walked with his son through addiction and has incredible wisdom to share with other families. It's really more of a memoir on a mission to share my journey and the people that I've met along the way with you. There are better solutions. Grab a copy of Curious for yourself and maybe one for a friend, and let's grow a movement toward life, health, and hope. That is so helpful, I think, to, it reminds me of a conversation I had with, somebody else who is in recovery, and he says, you know, so he would also say he doesn't refer to himself as an addict. I'm not even sure that he refers to himself even as like a person in long-term recovery, because he said it just that in thinking about like, well, why would my problematic substance use be different from somebody who was addicted to cigarettes for a long time? If somebody stops smoking cigarettes, we don't say that they should call themselves an addict for the rest of their life, because they used to smoke cigarettes. Or yeah, it just was like, why in some of these areas of problematic behavior that is leading to negative health outcomes or life outcomes, why in some areas do we allow people to move on and just be, you know, I'm Daniel. And yeah, a long time ago, I was addicted to nicotine or whatever it is, you know, and I smoke cigarettes, and yeah, now I don't anymore. But it is not a sort of this required continual identity that is part of who I am in the present, versus kind of that was a season of my life that isn't part of my life now in terms of behavior.
And you know, and that's so wonderful. It's such a great example, because my dream, like my vision for the way that we talk about addiction and recovery, is that it's so commonplace that it's no different than talking about any other challenge. Oh, I got in a car accident, and then I broke my pelvis, and I was in the hospital for 3 months, and blah, 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 blah. And like, that's just a story that someone might share with someone about an experience, a challenge that they've had, right? So my vision is that we speak about problematic substance use and recovery the same way. And part of how that happens is people like your friend, and I love that the point that he made, people like yourself talking about, like, this is, you know, you talk about in your book about the train crash, right? And that's like a story that you have words where you started telling publicly immediately, right? And I'm sure over time that's changed how you tell it and all that, but that it doesn't just take those of us in with the direct lived experience of problematic substance use, but everybody talking about all the things in just a normal way without shame attached to them. My goodness, problematic substance use is one of a huge list of stigmatized challenges. And so, you know, for folks thinking about how do I help, and how do I, you know, what lived experience do I have? What story do I have to tell? I'm like, you have the story of whatever challenge is that kind of, you know, we often have like a defining challenge in our life. How did you get through that? What did it feel like? It's not that different. I need the same things for my wellness as you and everybody else. So at the end of the day, we all just need meaning and purpose. We need to you know, believe in something, which feeds into that meaning and purpose. We need to feel valuable and worthy and loved and significant. We need to be in relationship with one another. We need to have fun and laugh and have joy. And so when we share our stories of reclaiming those things or of finding those things, of overcoming the challenges, it's all just part of one larger conversation. And so whatever your experience is, it maybe makes you care about incarceration, right? Makes you care about harm reduction, makes you care about whatever the things you care about are. What is your personal challenge that connects to that, that relates, that makes you feel like, hey, there's something similar. I know what it is to feel trapped. I always say, not everybody's been 5 months pregnant on methadone and incarcerated and looking at 2 years in prison, right? Most people have not, but everybody knows what it feels like to feel trapped or profoundly lonely or totally helpless or having no idea who you are. Like, there's so many elements of that, having no control in your life, that are universal. And the storytelling that matters, the storytelling that really changes things, changes hearts, is the kind of storytelling where we're talking about those universal human experiences and we're universalizing challenges and recovery and wellness from those.
That's beautiful. Well, I want to have one more question for you, and then I want you to tell people how they can get in touch with you related to the workshops that you lead. And I'll just go ahead and say, Megan worked with all of our speakers for our Shift Drugs and Addiction Summit. She was a speaker, and she was also working for us as a speaking coach for all of the speakers that we worked with. We had about 15, 17 people that were part of that day because we could it kind of like TED style, where 15 to 20 minute presentations. And there was a woman who was one of our speakers there, who's done lots of speaking all over the country. And there was an attendee there who had actually heard her speak at other conferences before. And they came up to me. They did not realize that our speakers were working with a storytelling coach. And they came up to me at the break and said, I have heard her speak for years. I've never heard her speak like this before, with so much of herself in that presentation. And it was profound enough that that's the thing that they came to tell me is. And so that is a tribute to Megan. She really has. We've had other people, friends that we've sent her way, who have said your coaching workshop is just absolutely phenomenal to help people tell their story. You could have heard a pin drop in the presentation auditorium when Megan was telling her own story during our summit. So I want to give you a chance to just tell people how they can connect with you. And if they're interested in, these are super cost effective. These are not like $3,000, you know, training events or anything like that. It's very, very affordable. So worthwhile. So encourage you to look into that. So I want you to do that. But before you do, we haven't talked much about kind of your own journey from the way that you thought about this kind of very clear cut, abstinence, inpatient treatment, 12 steps. And I know people are going to think I'm against that. I am for whatever helps somebody on their own journey. I am against forcing it into one path, that there is one path and it's either going to be that path or no path. And if it doesn't work for you, it's your fault. And then you've just got to figure out how to knuckle it through the one path. So that's what I want to kind of break apart, is to say there are, you know, millions of pathways, whatever pathway it is that works for you to build a life that is meaningful, that is the life that you want to be living, in a way that is healthy and whole and all of those things. So you have gone from that, from kind of being very specific about that path yourself, to now being very open to kind of that many different pathways, and let's meet people where they are. You alluded to that a little bit as you talk about the way you think about the beginning of your recovery was not the day you stopped using substances, but was the day you began to see that I want something different. And yet it took a number of other years before you got to the point in that journey where substances were no longer part of your journey. So talk through that shift for you.
I will. It's a big question, but I'll try to speak to, you know, succinctly to it. So the way that I see my journey now is that there were things that I was offered all along the way, and they all contributed, right? And each time that I accessed something, but didn't, you know, achieve or sustain total abstinence, I used to think that was a failure. And so I looked at it as a string of failures. because the only things that were offered to me were medication, like methadone and Suboxone, inpatient treatment, abstinence only, right? And 12-step abstinence only. So it was either succeed or fail. Either you had abstinence or you didn't, and this was the only bar that was set and the only achievement of recovery. And 18 years from my first 12-step meeting and my first stay in detox to when I used my last substance. Although I totally use substances, I love coffee.
Yeah, that's a good point. Even as I was saying, using substances, I thought, well, that's not actually fair to say use. That's maybe problematically. Yeah, it's a lot more nuanced.
No. And I've mostly put down sugar, but I still use it to reward myself. So I'm still using a substance. But you know, before I put down the substances that were really, really devastating for me. And so all along the way, I just kept accessing the same things over and over. I went to over 20 detoxes and inpatient programs. I was on methadone, Suboxone. I mean, I was in trials for Suboxone in 1999 before it was even really a thing, right? And I kept going back multiple times. And then I kept going in and out of 12-step because I was forced to. I did drug court, which is a whole different podcast. And that was forcing me to do 12-step. Ultimately, I ended up avoiding a 5-year prison sentence by going to a 1-year-long fundamentalist Christian inpatient program, delving into 12-step. And when I left that program, I was deeply involved in church and deeply involved in 12-step and achieved eventually abstinence-based recovery, which is what I practice today, simply because I have a really great life. So I'm like, I don't really need to like try to do anything else. I don't need anything, right? I have what I need, except I just wish I could have more coffee all the time. But what happens for a lot of folks, and what happened for me, is that I drank the Kool-Aid fully, and that's what I needed to do at that time. But those were the only things available to me. And so I tried them and tried them and tried them and tried them and tried them until finally there were external things that were in place for me that helped me make those things work. And after about 5 years of both deep involvement in church and deep involvement in 12-step, I started to feel like I feel like I've accessed most of what is available to me here. And there's other stuff I want to grow in other ways and see what else is there. And, you know, and so I kind of stepped outside of those two things and forged my own path, right? And so over those years, I've seen how many other things actually sustain me. And as the overdose deaths climbed and climbed and climbed, and I lost more and more people that I love, and I'd already lost so many in that 18 years anyways, it really made me question how effective 12-step actually is and medication. And they're incredibly effective for a lot of people. And then there's all the people they're not. Something I hear all the time is, you know, or I read it actually in a storytelling book, and I was like, why is this in a storytelling book? But there's a lot of science there to it, but I pledge allegiance to the thing that saved my life. So whatever it is that I believe saved my life, I pledge allegiance to that. I can't see outside of that. So I was, you know, all those years, like 12-step is it. I don't need to go anymore, but everybody should go. Abstinence is it. You can't moderate. Nobody can be successful with moderating, right? You know, this particular faith system is the right one for everybody, right? And as much as I still hold dear to much of Christianity, I also can recognize that it's not for everybody. And so I went from this hard line of what recovery looks like and what faith looks like and what spiritual, you know, and how it should be done, to realizing, oh my gosh, all these people are dying because that's not working. And so it started to really open me up. And then I was on my own journey of that. And so it started to be an all hands on deck. And I started listening to the harm reduction community. And oh my gosh, Unbroken Brain and Undoing Drugs by Maya Salovitz changed everything for me. And so those two books really helped me understand that I don't care what it is that you're doing. If I can interact with you in a way that supports the quality of life that you're looking for, I'm into it. Any positive change, I don't care what it is, because this gold standard of abstinence is not realistic. And it requires a lot of privilege. That's a whole nother piece, right? Not everyone has the privilege to access and maintain total abstinence, 12-step, or even medication. And so we don't need to have a lot of rules and restrictions and, you know, this definitions and all this. We just need people to be able to access things that help improve the quality of life as they say they want, as they declare for themselves. And sometimes they don't want an improved quality of life. And I'm just there to give you some love, right? Because we need that love and belonging. So now, you know, my view of it all is that people just need to figure out, pull in the pieces of what helps them be well and whole. And I wrote a class called Infinite Pathways of Recovery because I'm so passionate about it. And it's just getting down to your basic human needs and how do you meet them? It doesn't have to say recovery on it. It just has to help fulfill some of your needs. And so that is like 10 different things for me today. And so we can no longer hold this gold standard of abstinence, no criminal behavior, no substance use whatsoever, no, you know, disapproved of behaviors. You must be housed. You must, you know, have these, you have to have a career and, you know, we would love you to be alive first. And we would love to just meet you with love and support for whatever your goals are. And whatever small impact I can have on a positive change in your life, because all of the rest of it's not working.
So tell people how they can connect with you if they're interested in learning more about storytelling. How do they do
Yeah,
that?
So my website is meganperry.com. It's just Megan, MEGHANN, Perry, PERRY.com. Or you can reach out to me directly at megan@meganperry.com. We have storytelling workshops. We do one-on-one storytelling and speaker coaching. We love supporting events. Shift Events was wonderful. We get to meet really fascinating people and help them find their strongest, best, most kick-butt voice for whatever it is they care about. So we love doing that work. And we do a lot of training of the recovery workforce. We specialize in working with young people from prevention all the way through. So there's lots there. We have a free story gathering. If you just kind of want to dip your toe in and be like, what is this storytelling thing about? Or how does, you know, who's this Megan Perry people? We have those every other Sunday from 3 to 5 Eastern time. They're always free. They're on Zoom. So you can access all of that at meganperry.com, or hit me up on email, megan@meganperry.com, or Facebook too. My folks post a lot on Facebook. I'm not cool enough and young enough to be all over the Instagram and TikToks, but Facebook.
I feel you on that. I feel like I just missed the cutoff. I just turned 40 last year. I'm like, I don't get it. I can't keep up with all of it. It's just too much.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Megan. This was helpful. I'd encourage everybody to hop over to one of those storytelling things, hear Megan tell more of her own stories. It's just really powerful and learn how to do that. Storytelling is has been such a big piece of the work that Ender for Good has done. It's always been very important to us. Not that we've ever done it perfectly, but very important to us not to use people's stories, but to And to recognize when you're telling your own story, you're telling other people's stories too, who are related to you. If you're telling stories about your family, you are publicly talking about your family. And so it is really important to really take the time to think through, how do I want to share? What do I want to share? And Megan can help you think through some of those questions so that as you look back 5 years from now, you're happy with the decisions that you made and are continuing to build the kind of public story that you want to share with the world, which doesn't have to be everything about your life ever. It can be what you want to share about yourself with the world. So thanks so much, Megan.
Thank you. I love the work you're doing and for good. And it's been a real pleasure to have the conversation with you today. So thank you.
Thanks for joining us on the End It for Good podcast, and we'll see you next time. So how do we shift our drug policies from a criminal justice approach to a public health approach? By inviting one person at a time to change their mind. Changed minds are the catalyst to changed laws. But many people are only willing to have this conversation when they're invited to by someone that they trust. That's you. Invite your friends, coworkers, other people in your circle of influence to consider a better way. At End It for Good, our hope is that people who hear will become people who tell. Start a conversation and join the movement to end it for good.